So this is Dennis Avey, and it's Reel One. We're starting now, Dennis.
Splendid.
So I'd like to ask you about your background before the war started. Whereabouts were you born and brought up?
Yes. Well, I was born in a cedar farm in Thundersley, Essex. My father farmed there. And I was born there, and I stayed there for about 3 to 4 years. And then we came into a village called North Weald. And
whereabouts was North Weald?
In near Epping, Essex.
Oh, the same sort of area?
Yes. Well, about 20 miles away. And there I grew up amongst farming stock. I mean, as a baby, I think from the point of view of riding, I rode first in a basket saddle. And that's how early I started riding. And I was dragged up with animals, horses particularly. And, of course, we shot. We had a good shoot where we shot for the larder. And I always remember as a child complaining to my dear mother that I said, why am I not like other kids? Why can't I have sausages and things instead of partridge and pheasant and snipe? Must I always live on this stuff? You know, and I wanted sausages and all that. Would you believe it? I thought about this many, many times. However, we had a marvellous village life with boys and girls, lovely people. And we were always doing something, and there was always a season for something. And we were never, never at a minute's peace, ever. And I had a gang, would you believe? Not a gang, but an army. And we had lots of muzzle loaders around the house and air guns and what have you, and old French bayonets and stuff. And I had an army, would you believe it, as a child. And we used to really. And my dear grandfather, he used to go to... he used to be a big race man himself, horse racing. And all the medals, not medals, but... yes, they were medals that gave them entree into the various stands, you know, Newmarket, Epsom, what have you. And I had a load of these. And I always remember when I used to award someone with a medal, it was a big celebration, you know, and presenting arms. And I got some photographs of those days, but we had a marvellous time. Mm-hmm. We were into the forest and what have you. And in all, there was a season for everything. There were tops and bikes and climbing and paper chases and long, long races around the countryside and what have you, for little twopenny magazines. That used to be the prize. And we used to think this was absolutely marvellous.
Was farming very different in those days?
Pardon?
Was farming very different?
Oh, very, very much. You see, it was a horse farm. And horses were the thing. And, of course, when I look back at it now, by Jove, there was so much energy and effort put into... It was so inefficient as opposed to standards today. I mean, for argument's sake, you get a chappie on a machine, he can cut and he can silage and what have you in one fell swoop. Now, we had to cut with horses, a pair of horses with a mower, and we had to put up with horse flies and Lord knows what, cutting hay, cutting grass. Then we had to toss the hay by hand, pitchforks and what have you, toss them by hand. And then we had the big field rakes. They were two horses and tines about 15 to 20 feet long. And the horses used to pull these tines and pick up the hay and take them to the stack. And all the chaps used to have to get pitchforks and throw the hay right on top of the stack, and they used to make the stack. And that was it. And those were the days. But now they do it in one fell, and they think nothing of it. I mean, I always think about that in terms of how we got the acre, the measure of the acre. And the acre was done many hundreds of years ago. It was determined by a farmer and two, whether it's two oxen or two horses, I know not. But it was his, it was the area in which he could plough that land in one day. And that's how the acre was determined. And it's an odd size, but nevertheless, that was the common denominator of the measurement. And I always think about those days, and I think of them now, the efficiency we get today.
How about your education, Dennis?
I suppose it was my dear father, again. He had a big shine to me. I know he did. He never said as much. He never said as much at all. But he never, ever really praised me, not to my face, ever, throughout my whole life. But he was insistent on me getting a reasonable education at that time. Well, those days, you had to go to the village school right over the fields, about a mile and a half over the fields. But he didn't send me to that at all. He sent me to Epping Town, which was an Epping, the infants there. And I went to infant school and then the central school in Epping, and which I excelled at. I had red hair, freckles, and a temperament to match those days. I'd fight anybody, you know, if I thought it was unfair. Anything unfair, I used to fight against. And I was a pretty good athlete those days, and I won the senior championship twice at Epping, and I became head boy.
You know, this lovely boyhood, which you described so well, Dennis. Was there much talk in your childhood of the First World War? I know, you know, this. You would have been born later than that, but was there much talk?
Very little. Very, very, very little. I didn't hear my father say one thing, but I knew his background, and he didn't tell me. Well, his background was he was in the RHA, the Royal Horse Artillery, during the war, the First World War in France. And he wasn't wounded at all. He got away with it. He was remarkable. But he was a remarkably strong man. And he was a man I so much... admired.
Yes, he sounds a very remarkable man. But he didn't talk about the war at all to you.
No, he didn't at all. He never did. He was one of the finest, greatest Christians I think I've ever met.
Did war impinge on your young life?
Pardon?
Did these sort of events in Europe or the Spanish Civil War, did it impinge on your young life as you were
not
growing
at all
up?
But I do. One of our friends, he was older than I, he volunteered, and he was in Spain. I think he got killed, Leon Burton. And he was a weird sort of chap. He's very articulate and very precise. in point of fact, he used to balance, I always used to remember, he used to balance his bicycle wheels by putting another valve on the other side to balance them perfectly. He was that type of fellow. And he was with the, what do you call it, the Blue Brigade or whatever.
Yes, the International Brigade, was it?
Pardon? International Brigade, that's it. He was, and there was also a young girl at the pub. I was quite young at the time. And she must have been a communist because she always used to try and talk to us in that sort of way. And of course it was foreign, completely foreign. We weren't into that sort of thing at all. And that was it. But the Spanish War, I remember it very, very well. And in point of fact, immediately subsequent to the last war, well, not immediately subsequent, I went to Spain in the Basque country. And I couldn't believe it. There were still the results of the bombing and sniping and whatever, machine gun bullets, buildings in total disarray, you know. And nothing had been done for some years after the war. And this must have been the area in the Basque country that Leon must have fought in. But I never did see him, but I heard of him only. In point of fact, we were only talking, the last only two friends I've got left. We mentioned his name only the other day and said what a character he was. He was a one-off. He was completely, he was not in tune with the village at all. He was completely a different thinker altogether. And he came from a very, well, for want of a better word, a mundane family. You know, nothing, not that anybody is anything other than that, anybody.
How about Hitler and the rise of fascism? Did that impinge on your young life at all?
Not really. I knew of him. I knew of him, and I knew more particularly of Mussolini. And I was very impressed by the photographs that they used to show in the papers of his military men, his elite, jumping over fixed bayonets, a row of fixed bayonets. I always remember that. And I thought, what a silly ass trick, you know. because there's many a slip twixt cup and lip. And I thought, well, this is ludicrous. And I used to see him as a very pompous man and what have you. Hitler, I suppose I didn't get hold of the propaganda. Well, I got hold of his propaganda, but not of the dreadful things he was doing to the Jews. Although, oddly enough, in 1938, I will come to that, I went to Germany in 1938. In point of fact, as a result of being a student apprentice with Tate and Lars.
Oh, this was your, is this your career that you took up when you left school?
Oh, yes. Well, mm-hmm. When I left school, I didn't leave school, I got a scholarship for a technical college, which I passed. I got a free scholarship, but my father had to pay, because those days one didn't get a free scholarship. One had to be determined by the means test. If you weren't over a certain amount of money, you had to pay pro rata and what have you. And I went to technical college, and I was there for 5 years, four and a half years. And again, I did very, very well. I did it technically, academically, if you like, and on the sports field as well. I got the junior championship the first time I was there, and then the senior championship subsequently. But there it is, you know, one does these sort of things. And I obviously wanted to go to university. My father was all for it. Well, those days, my father used to have invite people for the shoot now and again, only now and again. And they were nice people. And one was a Dudley Wall and a Colonel Wall, his father. And they used to come down the odd times to shoot. And I used to know them pretty well. And the Colonel used to call me Rufus. Got a red hair, you know, always Rufus. And my father was talking to Dudley Wall. He was a director of Tate and Lyle's. As Colonel Wall was, I think, the managing director those days. And he suggested, and it was quite foreign to the procedure those days, it was suggested that I come to him for 2 years before going to university to get the practical experience of industry and what have you. And it was a brilliant place to get and so I went there as a student apprentice. They had everything but the kitchen sink there. They had a fleet of tugs. They had turbines. They had up-to-date boiler houses. They had the last word in packing industry and sugar manufacture. They had everything right across the board. And it was an experience that I really... learned a lot from. And then, unfortunately, the war was declared.
But you were saying you went to Germany in 1938.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Well, I was. One of my stints was to be in the sugar packing area. And I was greatly interested in machinery those days, in point of fact. I'd sooner watch a bank of machinery working than I would anything else those days anyway. But there it was, and Dudley Wall, we were bringing some machinery from Germany, some Hesse machinery. And I suppose I had rather a short line to him. He suggested that I go with two other people, which I went to. And it was quite an experience. Then, subsequent to that...
Whereabouts in Germany did you go?
Now, that I can't... I've tried to think about that. It was the Hesse fabric, the Hesse machinery. I forget where it was.
Did you see any signs of Nazism while you were there?
Nothing at all. Nothing at all. Now, that's the most amazing... That was in 1938. Anyhow... Another German used to come over. He was a big engineer, and I respected him as an engineer very, very much. His name was Fieker, and he was the AEG representative of the turbines manufacturers. And he used to come over, but he was essentially a man of the old days, you know. He used to come with cravat and morning coat on the valise. I used to go into the room, spread paper on the floor, and strip right the way down and rebuild himself into overalls and what have you. But he was a terrific man, but he was a terrifying man because his discipline was beyond. And I was the only person he would converse with. That's right. And he wanted me working on these turbines. He wanted me working on these turbines, which I did. But his discipline was beyond everything else. I remember on some governor gear valves, the valves were controlling the steam input into the turbines. And I remember one of our fitters, he was emerying some stems of valves with oil, and one of the pieces of emery, as it will do, comes off on his last stroke and made a slight scratch, only a superfluous scratch, across the stem of the valve. And he threw a hammer at him, and knocked him off the top of this turban, and he wouldn't apologize. Never. No, he said, that's bad, that's checked. A bad work, he said, but which it wasn't. But that was my first approach to the sight of the German attitude. That was my first experience of it.
And you were going to get a bit more of that later, weren't you, Dennis?
Pardon? So yes, and quod erat demonstrandum.
Right. Well, did you have intimations that war was breaking out? You know, 1939?
Not really. Not really. I didn't used to read the papers at all those days. I was too interested in other things. Motorcycles. I mean, we were into motorcycles and motor cars. We used to build motor cars and out of 500cc motorbike engines, build the car and race them, would you believe, on the airport down south. What's the big airport down south now?
Heathrow.
No, not Heathrow. The one...
Gatwick?
No.
Croydon? There used to be one. Oh, Stansted.
Stansted.
Really?
We used to race them down there. Oh. Would you believe it? And I even, as young boys, I was still at college, I remember two of us bought a dirt track Ogden. We used to race it on Sunday mornings on High Beach Dirt Track. And those days, it was right in the middle of Epping Forest, right in High Beach. And it was a purely circular track. And that was the first dirt track that was ever made in England. And when they started it, not in my time, but when they first started it, the people, the spectators used to be stood inside the track rather than outside it. Can you imagine that? Anyway, we only had one pair of leathers with us, but we had some marvellous times.
So when war came, was this a big shock for you? Well, do you remember when war broke
out? I suppose, yes, in one way. But again, you see, I'll tell you about Calais. Calais was a long way. It was another world, Calais. You know, even people never travelled those days at all. Never travelled. And, I mean, for argument's sake, when I used to play for Leighton Boys football. And then I played a few games for London Boys. And we came up to Sheffield. And we played on Sheffield United's ground in 1932, I think it was, thereabouts, against Sheffield Boys, Rotherham, and a mishmash of people, and we beat them about 10-0. And we were guests in the afternoon of Sheffield United. And I always remember the match, because the match, it was against Newcastle United. And I always remember Sammy Weaver, who was the right half. And he was the only man in FA football that could throw that type of ball from the touchline right into the goal mouth. Because those days, it was a very heavy leather out case and used to have a rubber bladder inside. And they were very heavy balls those days, not like the balloons they have now.
So
and it was quite a feature. Well, my point is that when I came up here, I thought this was another planet.
So when we started, did it seem a long way off then?
Oh, it was miles away. It was another planet, exactly. The dialect was very heavy, and the whole environment was a foreign environment.
Do you remember, though, the day war broke out, where you were and how you reacted to it?
Yes. I think it was a Sunday, was it? Was it a Sunday? I think we were playing tennis behind the Talbot, as we did do most Sundays. And there's on Sunday, and I believe there was an air raid warning. I can't really remember those details at all.
Did it affect your life, you know, quite quickly, the outbreak
no,
of war?
No, not at all.
Did you continue with Tait and Lyle? Were you still with them?
Well, I then started, I don't know, I suppose I started getting, reading papers, I was more towards that, and when the war started, yes, I was very interested, and then they said it would affect us, you know. And then it went on for a bit, and it became closer. And I remember the maps that used to come about in the paper, showing the approach of the Nazi regime, you know, or the Nazi troops. Anyway, and then the realization that war was coming about, without any doubt at all. And I always remember people in the village, especially my dear aunt or wretched aunt, whichever way I look at it, hoarding all this sugar, and I couldn't understand it. And she used to have pounds and pounds and pounds of it. You know? And I thought, God forbid, what on earth is that for? I didn't. You must understand that our appreciation of life and whatever was totally different to the people of that age now. They have a very adult approach to news and whatever than we ever did. We were still kids, virtually, in
how
that
old,
sense.
Yes, how old would you have been when war
20.
Started? So you were old enough to...
oh, yes.
Yes,
but
to
we were still young, very young, and not appreciable of those sort of situations, you see. Now, they would be today, totally, totally. It's a different, totally different thing today.
But you realised, did you, Dennis, that you would be involved?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Did
the
you want to be?
Conscription was coming about, and I volunteered. And oddly enough, I wanted to fly, as my sister did. My sister flew, and she got her license, and I didn't. I was too busy in other things, you know. I was, every day was, I had to cram my life into that time, and I couldn't do it. Well, in point of fact, even when I was a student apprentice, although I was 4.5 years at college, I still went to night school three nights a week. And
did you volunteer for the RAF then?
Yes, absolutely. And they sent me away. They said, come back next week, you know, when we get organised a bit. That was my impression. Anyway,
what date would that have been when you volunteered?
September.
1939. Really? Immediately you volunteered?
Well, immediately when war was apparent, yes. And a friend of my father's in the War Office. I went to see him. He lived at Ongar. I forget his name now. And I went to see him. I said, his name was George. I always remember George, because that's my second name. And my father, dear father's name. What can I do? I've burned my boats. I volunteered, and that's... Well, he said, don't worry. He said, join a London mob and let me know. London regiment, let me know. He said, and I'll get you a transfer. And, of course, it never happened like that. I joined the Rifle Brigade, which was truly a London mob, and they were all regulars. And of course, one had to put up with a lot of other things apart from really intensive training. And
where was your training?
At Winchester.
What sort of training did they give you?
Well, a lot of basic drill and basic education into rifles, machine guns, mortars and what have you. But more particularly on field craft, you know. On we used to do route marches. We had a very... They talk about what courses do they go on now. They were very, very... They were kids' play to what we had to do because we had the true... what do they call them? Regular soldier attitude.